I was thanking the Lord for you, for this church this morning. As Devon and I prayed prior to the service, and I was just so thankful for you. You're James chapter 2 church. You know, and the rich and the poor come in. You treat them both with love and dignity. James says, if a poor man, poorly clothed and fed, comes in and you say, go and be warmed and filled, and you don't give him what's needed, your faith is dead. And we've already had a young man in here this morning who came in with nothing but the clothes on his back, didn't have socks, didn't have gloves, didn't have a coat, didn't have a hat. And we were able to, he spent the night at the warming shelter, and he came here and we gave him things. And so we said, go and be warmed and filled with a coat and clothes and sweatshirts, and we were able to help him. You are a James chapter 2 church, and I am just absolutely blessed to be a part of it with you. Thank you for supplying and helping and taking care of that. I'm in Esther again. What an amazingly relevant letter. Before we do that, I think I can sufficiently make us all squirm a little bit in our chair. Let me tell you three stories that pertain to what we talked about last week. Last week, if you remember, Esther chapter 1, background to this story. This government in Esther with male leadership really just dominating, domineering, crazy male leadership. And I said that any government like that will misdiagnose life, misdefine terms, and misdirect us in the course of life. That's what happens. But it was about male leadership. And I said, don't saddle the church with your male leadership issues. It's a human thing. It's humanity. We as humans are broken, and we get into leadership and we dominate and domineer and oppress. It's not the church's old-fashioned way. Don't define terms. Don't let them define our terms. Don't let them direct our course. We have a course. We have terms. God has predetermined that action. So three things, three current issues to show you, to give you some examples of what I'm talking about, that it is on the front page today in our news. Number one, and I don't mean to throw the Methodist Church under the bus. That's not my point. Methodist Church worldwide is meeting for 4 days right now. And the meeting will involve their definition or new definition of what a marriage is and what a minister can do, or who can minister. So they're going to meet worldwide, people from all over the world, Methodist denomination meeting for 4 days. I think it started yesterday. Does a marriage, is it a man and a woman? Is it anything? And the same with a minister. What orientation? All that whole discussion that I'm almost sick of talking about. So they're going to meet and decide what language to do in the Methodist Church Constitution. Okay? That's nothing new. A lot of denominations doing that. Nothing new. But let me get to my point of this. They've come out and said there are three possibilities for them. One is they stay with their traditional language, a marriage is a man and a woman, and a minister is a man of or a woman of one wife, and so it's the traditional marriage, or traditional minister, traditional male-female roles. Okay, that's their first option. Their second option, and what it will be one of these next two, is that they change what a marriage is. They change the definition of the term marriage to include anybody or anything, and the same for a minister. They will ordain their ministers of any orientation, of anything at all. And so their second option is that they change the whole language, the whole definitions, and it's worldwide. This is our banner. This is our constitution. What's interesting is the third option. The third option is that they reword it. It's new definitions, but it's only has to be applied by the local districts themselves. So it's like, here's who we are, but you don't have to, in your district or in your church, you don't have to apply this. But this is who we say we are. You are free as a district, say Indiana, Northern Indiana, or however they do it. You are free to not apply this or apply this, depending on your district and your congregation. So three options: across the board change, stay the same, or change it but not apply it. Let the individual districts and churches apply it. So without getting into any of that discussion, here's what applies to what I taught you last week. As far as definitions of terms, apparently they're not getting their definition of terms from here anymore. If there's a whole new language option, or there's a traditional option, biblical option, right? We might go this way and totally redefine it, or we might go with the old definitions here. They're actually debating two different definitions of marriage minister. And so what they're debating is culture's new definition of marriage and minister versus the old standard biblical definitions. See what I'm saying? I don't want to discuss the issue. I already know where I stand on the issue. But I want you to see an instant happening as you sit here where they are being persuaded by definitions of culture. They're not going by this anymore because they're admitting we have two possibilities. So this is a very real discussion that we're having with letting culture give us definitions. And it's just not those two. They will define your life and mine for us in a lot of ways if we let them. Okay? So that's my first example. This is real. I'm not lying to you. I'm not just creating something because I have to speak this morning. Secondly, male leadership gone awry. And I'm just going to be honest with you. So Harvest Bible Chapel, WFRN, 11 o'clock, James McDonald, ever hear him? Anybody ever hear him? Yeah? Okay, he's no longer pastor there. He's been let go for heavy-handed leadership. Things run amok in a big way. Churches, satellite sister churches, one in Granger, it just got too big, too much power, too much authority, just trampling on people apparently, and had to let him go eventually. Terry was reading me, telling me some of the articles, some of the stuff. It can happen here, is what I'm saying. I'm going to be honest with you. This guy would be in my camp. This is a church person, a leader of church. It can happen here. If we let it, it will come to a theater near you. You know what I'm saying? This is a human thing. It can land anywhere. As I mentioned last week, Ray Rice of the Ravens, you know, male leadership gone amok all over. Michael Jackson, Bill Cosby, icons of our culture fail. R. Kelly this week now, 10 things of abuse. So it's everywhere. It's not just us. This is not our problem. We do have the solution, but it is not our problem. But, okay, that's number. Here's one of the funniest ones. Here's one of the weirdest ones, okay? It's not funny. It's sick, but it's funny. All right. So here's this senator of Minnesota faced with fresh accusations of belittling staffers. A new report that she berated a staff member in an airport who brought her a salad and forgot the plastic fork. And so she berated him, sent him back for a plastic fork, and when he got back, she was eating it with a comb she had taken out of her purse. She's a senator? Who voted for this woman? So she eats this salad with a fork and then hands him the comb and says, "Now clean my comb." Down the way it says, according to a report, former aide said she's not just demanding, she's dehumanizing. And there's a full-length article about a female in power who absolutely berates and dehumanizes her staff members. So again, I will say this whole leadership thing, this whole thing of terms and male-female relationships, and this whole genre of conversation, we cannot let culture lead us in this. They are messed up. We have what God has predetermined from the beginning of time. Let's just apply it to our lives. We will be safe and we will be free from all the flopping and trending that's going on. But those are today's headlines. So I just wanted you to see some examples, and I will be the first to discuss church at fault. It's wrong, and I'll be the first to say church leadership screws up. We get involved in this. I'm not going to hide that from you either. We're no better than anybody else. We have to own our own responsibilities. So that's Esther chapter 1. I just applied it. Is all I did. That was a big application. We're at Esther chapter 2, and I want you to know that we're still in the background of this story. This story is a great, like, movie that's kind of leading to a climax. It's leading to this great conflict, this great main scene. And we are still filling in the pictures. We're still in the first half hour of the movie, and we're just filling in some backdrop that's all going to lead up to this great conflict and then a climax of this story that's absolutely amazing. But today, I want to look at this chapter, and probably change the way you look at this chapter and this person. So let me read Esther chapter 2, beginning at verse 5. Just follow along with me. Esther chapter 2, verse 5. We're finally getting to meet our main characters, the two main good guys, if you will, of this story. There was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai. He was the son of Jair, the son of Shemai, the son of Kish. Kish was a Benjamite who had been taken captive from Jerusalem. He was among the captives carried away with King Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. Mordecai was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and edict were proclaimed, and that order and edict was, find me a new wife, find me a new queen. When many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in custody of Haggai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. So King Ahasuerus, it wouldn't take long before you're sleeping alone and you go, "Man, Vashti, yeah, she was a little ornery, but man, I kind of miss her. I kind of like, she was pretty cool." That's what happened at the beginning of the chapter. And somebody said, "Well, hey, there's a lot of women, man, a lot of fish in the sea. Let's just round some up and get you a new..." Not to mention that he had a couple harems going. So, I mean, it's not like he didn't have bed partners. He did. Huge harems going. But the queen, I mean, the one was gone, and he missed her. So the young guy says, let's just gather up some hot women from around. You got a big kingdom, and get you a new one. And so that's the edict that went out, and so they did. They went out, his people, his soldiers, went out into the provinces looking for all the good-looking women, man. I mean, hey, you're coming with us. You're coming. Take them right out of their homes. Took Esther right out of her home there with Mordecai, right out of her community. Come on, you're coming with us. And they took them into custody. They took them into the main palace area. They were, it was forcible. It was not volunteer. She didn't sign up. So she's taken into custody and put in charge. There's I don't know how many women there were, but there was this new harem, this new group put in charge of Haggai. This guy here, he's your boss now. You live here with him. Anything you need, you see him. He's in charge. Okay, so that's the situation. Verse 9. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor. And he quickly provided her with cosmetics, her portion of food, with 7 chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or her kindred, she's a Jew, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. Now when the turn came for each young woman to go into King Ahasuerus after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, this was the regular period for their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh, 6 months with spices and ointments for women. When the young woman went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem in custody of Sheashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. So there's the first harem. They haven't been into the king yet. The king says, I want... And she can take anything she wants. I mean, she can take the clothes, whatever. She goes in the evening. She spends the night with the king. In the morning, she goes back to the second harem, the harem of the concubines or the wives. But she doesn't go back again unless he asks for her by name. That's the layout of this situation. Verse 15. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter, when the time came for her to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. So she said, he said, hey, Esther, king's asking for you, tonight's your night. And she said, okay. What do you think I should take with me? So he tells her, whatever it is, we don't know. Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women. And she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. He married her. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. So there's a word throughout this chapter. We see that she pleased people. She pleased Haggai. She was winning favor in everybody's sight. She certainly won the king's favor. He delighted in her. She found grace and favor. Esther was just a well-liked person. There was just something about her that was winsome. people liked her. And I would say, number one, that Esther's kindness and submission, it surely helped her in this story. You know, to ask Haggai, hey, I'm going to see the king. What do you think? I mean, there's a submission there. There's a kindness there that everybody just fell in love with Esther. And I would say for Esther, her kindness and submission, even in this very difficult government, in this almost captive situation of male dominance, of male-female just gone awry, her kindness and submission in this surely helped her. And I would remind you and I that when it comes to any of these discussions, to politics, to male-female roles, relationships, sexuality, there is one default mode, and that is kindness that we have. That is all we have. You want to talk truth? That's fine. You go right ahead. But you never leave kindness at home. Kindness is ours to wear 24/7. It helped Esther in a very difficult situation, and it will be a good thing for us to remember. Kindness and submission helped Esther a lot. But the question is, and here's the really thought-provoking part of this question, was Esther a hero of the faith? Do you read chapter 2 and go, Esther, man, you won it. You kicked it, man. Esther, was she a hero of the faith in this chapter? The answer is yes and no. Yes and no. No, because there's compromise all over this chapter. There's sin all over this chapter. Yes, she became queen. Yes, she's in a position now to really help. Yes, she's her name's the title of this letter, right? But no, and I'll be honest with you, early Jewish Orthodox, and maybe even today, they're not near so quick to immortalize and iconize Bible people, even Old Testament. They don't put them up on pedestals near like you and I do. It's our culture here in America. I mean, it's the American Idol thing, you know, boom, wow, you're a hero, wow, you're amazing, wow. Jewish thinking doesn't do that. And Orthodox Jewish thinking certainly doesn't do that. And they didn't do that with Esther. Do you know who the hero of the book of Esther was to Orthodox Jew? Mordecai. Why is that? Why do you think that is? Well, if you know anything about Jeremiah 29, God told Israel, when you get taken captive, don't fight it. When Nebuchadnezzar comes in and just levels your land, burns your property, destroys, kills, and takes you captive, don't fight it. You better go. And when you get there, just make a home for yourself. Settle in, make a home for yourself. Seek the good of the country, the good of the king, the good of the towns you live in, because if they're safe and if they're well off and if they're good, you're going to be, because you are on your own. So when you go, just support your government, support your person, support your town. It's where I'm putting you. And you will help yourself by falling in line with the people of your new nation. And so Esther and Mordecai, they had done that. They had made themselves at home here, but what you need to know is Esther and Mordecai weren't taken captive. And this is key for you to understand. They were taken captive 120 years ago. Esther and Mordecai were born there in Persia or in Babylon. They were born in a different country. They grew up there in Babylon, Persia. They didn't grow up in Jerusalem or Judah or Israel. They grew up there. But there were communities and people of Jews there, and they were Jews, so they went to their synagogue or their gathering. In Persia, when they took you captive, their philosophy was, we're going to let you kind of be you to a point. We're going to bring you in, whoever you are. You can live and move and breathe in your communities with your people. You can have your religion. Just kind of keep it low. Keep it to yourself. Because the main thing is our country and our government and our leaders and the good of our country. So come on in. Do the best you can for yourself. We'll even let you have your religion. Have your little distinctives of who you are. But just kind of keep it at your house, will you? Just kind of keep it low. Don't talk about it. Don't be out evangelizing in the streets. Don't be talking your stuff. Just keep it there. Support Persia. Support us. We're the main thing. We're who you really worship. You just keep that private. Keep that there. So Esther and Mordecai and the Jews had done that. They were there in Persia, had their communities, had their thing going on there. But you can sense in this the compromise and the sin of what's happening here. And it is sin against the Jewish culture. It's sin against New Testament Christianity. It is compromise and sin. Let me show you what I mean. So they're here in Persia, so to speak, with their Jewish community, but they're a little bit undercover. And so it's obvious from the beginning that they hide their identity. I'm going to give you seven ways that they compromise or sin. Number one, they hide their identity. It just says plainly, Mordecai told her, do not let anybody know you're a Jew. Verse 10, she had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai commanded her not to make it known. So she hides her identity. Now that's a sin against a Jew. I mean, that's just wrong as a Jew reads this. But she did it. She was hiding her identity. Number two, she goes by her Persian name, not her Jewish name, Hadassah. So if you're going to hide your identity, you don't go by your Jewish name, right? Hadassah. Esther's a Persian name. It means star. And it's actually, if you trace it back, there's some Persian gods that are associated with this name. So don't feel bad, Esther. You're all right. You're still with us. You're still part of this. Okay? But she in hiding her identity, she goes by her Persian name. And truth be known, Mordecai probably worked here in the palace. He didn't just get that access to the harems and the king's gate. He had some kind of a job up in here. So he had a really great job. Here's an interesting one. It just gives the whole flavor of this book. God is not mentioned in Esther. You won't find the name God in Esther. He's nowhere to be found. And Esther's had some issue over the years with different Bible people because God's not mentioned here, neither is prayer. And when she says later on, fast for me for 3 days, she doesn't say fast and pray. She says fast. So God and prayer are not mentioned in this letter. And that's kind of this kind of undercover like thing of Esther. It's like, where's God? Where's God? Where's God? Well, he's here. He's just kind of down here somewhere, just kind of kept behind the curtain, so to speak. That's the flavor of this book. The compromise of this book. The compromise is really turns into sin when you realize she went, when her night came, she went in and she slept with the king. I mean, there's no other way to say it. Hey, Esther, it's your night. You'll be coming back tomorrow morning. You're going into the king. There's only one thing expected here. She went in and slept with the king that night. She could have raised Cain. She could have said, I'm not sleeping with him. She could have done all that. And he'd have done the same thing she did. He did with Vashti, probably. She slept with him, and she pleased him and won great favor and grace with him. And then he married her. And then he put the crown on her head and married her. Outside of the Jewish people would have a fit, and they did. The early Orthodox Jews, the Talmud, didn't like it. Part of them didn't even like Mordecai. They called him the court Jew. because he was the token Jew there in the palace. He worked there. They knew he had a job. It's understood from this passage. And there was some of them that wrote bad things about Mordecai. They should have rebelled. They should have fought. They should have stood up for themselves. And if nothing else, just got kicked out and killed for their Jewish heritage. But they didn't. They went along with it entirely. Entirely. To the point she asked Haggai, what should I take with me? I want to do a good job. So he marries her. And I would say number seven, this is not a Daniel moment. This is not a Daniel moment. You remember Daniel? Daniel says, they give him the food and he says, I don't want your food. I'm not eating your food. It's not clean. It's not kosher. It's not right. I want vegetables. I want you bring me food. I'm not eating. And Daniel drew a line in the sand and said, no, this is it. Daniel's the one that was praying on the balcony. And they said, there's no praying. And Daniel said, forget you, I'm praying. Right? So you know the story of Daniel. This is not a Daniel moment. This is a moment where they were totally going with this crazy government, this crazy king, this crazy situation. They went with it. They flowed with it. Compromise, sin. What this really is a story of God's sovereignty. At this point, this is a story of God's total control, God's sovereign grace over two events happening simultaneously. And this is really key. I want you to understand this. There are two events happening simultaneously. There are two totally different types of people happening here, and God is in control of it all. This is key for you and I to understand that. What do I mean by that? 120 years ago, they were taken captive. 70 years later, they were let go. King Cyrus came and said, you tired of this? You want to go back to your homeland and rebuild your city, Jerusalem? Rebuild your temple? Go. I'll help you. That was 50 years ago from this. Esther and Mordecai didn't go. They stayed. They had so made their home here in Persia. It was a fraction of the captives that were now in this region, only a fraction left their homes, left their communities, left their jobs, and said, yeah, we're going back. We're going to risk life and limb to go back to a field and rebuild our city and our town. We're going. We'll sacrifice it all. We'll leave it all. We're going back to rebuild Jerusalem. Less than 10% left. The whole rest of them stayed. They had so assimilated into culture, they stayed. Esther and Mordecai stayed. Mordecai had a job in the palace. Things were apparently settled and well for them. So here you have those who went back, risking life and limb to rebuild. And you have all those other ones who stayed in Persia, in Babylon. And quite honestly, they were Persian. Esther was born in Persia. She was Persian with a Jewish core, a Jewish heritage. But they were Persian. They were Babylonian. They were born there. They had citizenship there. If you're born in America, you're American. But you have a Hispanic or German or whatever culture, heritage. That was Esther and Mordecai. Born Persian, raised Jewish somewhat, versus what's going on back in Jerusalem where 50 years ago they made this journey across the desert with hardly anything and people hating them, went back, rebuilt the temple at risk of life and limb, Jews there and Jews there. Two different events at the same time happening. What would these people in Jerusalem say about these people that stayed? Where's your heart, man? Where's your guts? Where's your God? Why are you doing? Why don't you all come back and rebuild? Come on, what are you doing? And there's those here still in Persia, knowing they have relatives. They've went back, they've risked life and limb, but now I'm not leaving my home. And what we need to see is God oversaw both sides. He was sovereign. He was in total control of both sides, blessed both sides. Because the story ends really well for the Jews there in Persia with Esther as the queen. Her compromise wasn't a medal on her chest. It was compromise and sin, but God was still there with her. God was still with them. He saw two sides of people. Quite honestly, Esther grew up and had no recollection or no memories of life in Jerusalem. She had no back knowledge to draw from. Remember when we were back in Jerusalem and the temple and all that was going on? And you remember the good old days? She had none of that. She was raised a Persian. And then you had those other people risking life and limb. So what is this story about? What are we talking about here? Let me give you three applications to this story. And one is that you have to see that the assimilation into culture, right? We have, please understand this, as you look across the American landscape today, as you look in this church, and if we were a church of 1,000, it would be really easy to do. There are some of us who remember the Christian-valued America. And there are some who are a little bit younger, being raised up. They have no idea what we're talking about. Matter of fact, they're growing up with a whole different tilt on life in America from what they know, from how they've been raised. I'm old enough to remember a more Christian-valued American. Some of you are much older than I am, Vera. Vera knows a Christian-valued America from 90-some years ago. She's seen America in its better, more glory days, so to speak. Skylar doesn't know. It's okay. It's okay. God's in control of both. God will use both. God's totally in control of all these generations that see it from a whole different viewpoint. God never left Esther or Mordecai, watching her go in and sleep with the king, try and please the king, winning favor, becoming queen. God hadn't left. He blessed. He blessed. Now we have that tension going on in our country today from those who knew the old America. This wasn't the way it was when I was wrong. We have those. And then we have our younger believing brothers and sisters coming up who don't know that America. But don't you think for a minute God isn't with them. God isn't blessing them, and God's going to use them for His purpose and His will. They weren't raised then. That's a natural thing. God's big enough. Let me tell you, God is big enough. He's in control. It's fine. Just relax. That's this story. That's this story. Two events simultaneously. One willing to risk their life and die to go back and build. Another one assimilating into their new culture, being raised Persian, assimilating, flowing with it. God's still there. God's still there. Assimilation, it does have a limit. I mean, you can only go so far. And I would say that, be careful, you can only go so far if you're going to assimilate with your culture. And it's hard to control. I mean, it will sweep you along if you're going to assimilate into your culture rather than into Scripture. Just be careful because it's going to pick up momentum. It's hard to control. And the further you get, it's not freedom, it's captivity. If you remember, if you think about this story, Esther and Mordecai weren't free. They remained captive there in Persia. They stayed close to this crazy king. It's the other ones that wanted freedom that left and went back. They still were under Persia, but they had a lot more freedom than those who said, no, we're going to stay here in Susa, which, by the way, is kind of right along Saudi Arabian area. We're going to stay here. Although they knew the government was crazy. This king is crazy. We're going to stay here. Assimilation is really not freedom. It's posed as freedom to be what you want, who you want, under our definitions and terms, but you're really not free. So be careful with the assimilation. It's difficult. Romans chapter 6 reads this way. You don't want to take my word for it. Take the Bible's word for it. Just listen as I read. What then? Are we to sin because we're no longer under law but under grace? By no means. Don't you know that if you present yourselves to anyone as obedient slaves, you're a slave of the one whom you obey, either of sin, which leads to death, or of obedience, which leads to righteousness. So they lead to further things. Assimilation will sweep you up and lead you, and you can only go so far. Thanks be to God that you who were once slaves of sin, you've become obedient from the heart to the standard of teaching to which you are committed. You've been set free from sin. And what he just said was, you believed and were saved, and all your sins were forgiven. No condemnation for you. But, listen, you've become slaves of righteousness. I'm speaking in human terms because of your natural limitations. Just as you once presented your members as slaves to impurity and to lawlessness, leading to more lawlessness, now present your members as slaves to righteousness, leading to sanctification. Assimilation has to stop somewhere. If you're going to flow into the culture a little bit, somewhat, just understand, if you're looking at it that way, it's got to stop somewhere because they lead to more things. Assimilation into a sinful culture, it leads to spiritual death. Even for those of you who gave yourself to Christ, who were forgiven, there's no condemnation in you. Sin leads to more sin. Assimilation leads to more and more and more. And somewhere you're going to have to draw a line and say, I can't go any farther. Some of us are drawing the line back here. But if you're going to flow a little bit with the culture, you're going to have to draw a line because it leads to more. Righteousness, on the other hand, also leads to growth and sanctification. So if you start into this and you begin to present your bodies as slaves to righteousness, it leads to more. You grow and you grow and you grow. So assimilation, be careful with that, how far we flex into culture. Be careful that it doesn't go from compromise to sin like Esther in chapter 2. They were set free but chose to stay in captivity and serve. So be careful with saying we live in a new day, in a new world, in a new culture. It doesn't stop. You can't sit still. It goes and keeps going one way or the other. Secondly, and I say this mainly to you older folks who are fed up, disgusted, frustrating, and downright almost hostile with the new America. And I say that willfully. The new America. We're living in a new America. It's changing every day. It's a new America. It's a Persian America. You can have your faith, just sit still and be quiet with it. Keep it at home. Don't ruffle culture, government. We are the final say. Just sit still. But you can be who you are. Thank God we're still able to do this. Yeah. But for those of you who are of an older flavor, who are just almost hostile with this stupid government stuff going on, God's sovereignty should take the edge off that. God's in control in Persia and in Jerusalem. God's not out of control here in America. He's in control. And just knowing that should keep you from reaching to the medicine cabinet for that bit of relief in that bottle. Just relax. God's in control. It'll take the hostility out of you. Here's a compromising lady, totally captivated, totally now into the core of a crazy king and a crazy government, and she's right there. What are you? You married the guy. God's in control. Trust me, I've read the rest of the story. God's in control. When you feel frustrated, about to pop, about to blow your mind, about to throw something at that TV, I'm not watching one more of those newscasts because they drive me nuts. You got to go to God's sovereignty. You got to go. God is in control. And let the panic and the frustration and the hostility subside, because God is big enough to be in control of Persia and Jerusalem. It's okay. Whoever gets voted in, whether this lady that eats salad with a comb, if she's the next president of the United States, my God's in control, we're fine. We're fine. I know, I don't like it either. There's parts I think are really dumb. We're fine, because my God is way bigger than any president of the United States and any governor or senator or mayor. He is bigger. He is bigger, isn't he? Isn't your God bigger? It's okay. It's okay. Don't lose your sanctification over it. It's fine. We're okay. Let this story be hope for you. Number three, those of you who are serving communion, get ready. Number three, Esther is a story, it's a power play. The book of Esther is a power play. And in Esther chapter 2, she pleases the power. She fits in, she assimilates, she goes with it, she eats food she shouldn't be eating as a Jew, she takes her cosmetics in, she does all the right things, asks, hey guy, what should I take in? She sleeps with the guy, she marries the guy, she is in it, way over her head, way past. She pleases the powers to be. That's wrong. But fighting the power, or fighting for the power, is equally as wrong. Pleasing the power is not the right approach. Fighting for power is not the right approach. Don't buy into this. You have to fight for the power. It's my Christian life is not about being in power. Is it? It's not about being in power. We do not get sucked into the power play. We've got to fight. What is it? Some North Carolina dude, just they're going to reelect because he fought for the power a little bit too far. Voter fraud. They're going to do a whole new election. His own kids turned him in. We don't fight for the power. We already have the power. My God is the power. I'm showing them I'm scared to death if I'm fighting for the power. What's the answer? That you and I need to know then, what do I do? If I don't fit in and assimilate, I don't just bend over, please the power, and I'm not supposed to fight for power. We've got to be in control. What do we do? You won't like my answer. It's the cross. It's the cross. I ask you, did Jesus please the governmental cultural powers? No. Did he fight for power? What did he do? He died. He suffered. He lived and spoke his truth. And if you loved him, you loved him. And if you hated him, you hung him on a cross. And he died. And he suffered. And he won. That's your course. That's your course. It doesn't matter who's the next president, who's the next governor, who's the next mayor. It doesn't matter. Our call is to suffer. It's to live it openly, love openly, speak it openly, suffer openly. That's our call, suffer. Let them hit you. If they want to hang us on a cross, go ahead. I'm not giving you my definitions. I'm not surrendering the definitions of marriage or of ministry or of anything else. I'm not giving up my definitions. I'm not giving up my direction. But I will be kind and submissive like Esther. I will speak the truth and I will live this truth. I will live Jesus in the cross, and our call is to suffer. It's not there yet. I get yelled at once in a while. But we're not getting beat up yet. Most of us. That's your calling. That's your calling. We're not giving up our definitions. We're not giving up our course. We're not surrendering to a misdiagnosis of life. But you know what? Just remember, those who weren't raised in Jerusalem, they're coming up. They still are with the Lord. They just know a different America, and they're finding the Lord in the new America, in Persian America. But they've still committed to that doctrine of sound teaching. They've still given their life to Christ, but they're coming from a different path in the new America. You and I are coming from this path. We remember, Christian America. But we're all the Lord's. And God's big enough. He's over it all. He's good enough. My God is. I don't know about yours. Mine is big enough. He's in control. He's got this. This is what we're called to. Just embrace it. My servers would come forward. We're going to take communion. If you're going to take this communion, you might as well say, Lord, this is me. I'm supposed to take up my cross and follow you. I mean, don't take it if you really don't want to live it. That's what I would say. And let's do them both together. Let them pass out the bread. We'll come back. We'll get the cup. We'll just do them both together. And come on up, Jackie. We're good. You're good. You're good. We don't care. We're easy here. Let's go ahead and pass those out. Come on back up. I'll give you the cup. Go ahead. Go ahead and pass it out. So don't misunderstand me. We have the freedom in our country to vote. We have the freedom to worship, the freedom to have conversations, freedom to call your senator, whatever. But don't lose hope. Don't lose your kindness. Don't lose your sanity. Don't lose your temper. Your God is in control. The biggest thing on my heart is to understand that these new young Americans are growing up in a new America than what us older ones, but we're all on the same team. Use this story as hope for you. God is in control of both sides, both stories happening at the same time. God's in control. Don't fight for power. That never is the scriptural way. We don't fight for power. We die for people. Here is who you say you are. In the new America, is it? That's our call to suffer. Are you ready? Are you ready? Let's drink it together. Got something for us up there, Mark? A little screen. I call it a new America, Persian America. This man has some wisdom for us. Sometimes your freedom is not taken away at gunpoint, but instead it's done away one piece of paper at a time, one seemingly meaningless rule at a time, one small silencing at a time. Armando Valladares, Cuban prisoner for 22 years. When I was in Bible college, I was a whitewater rafting guide, amongst other things, and we have a lot of people coming in from all over the country. And I've had Cubans say to me, who have come from Cuba, to say, be careful, your country seems to be heading in the same direction we once traveled. One paper, one bill, one rule. They're not going to come in at gunpoint and change our life. It'll be one law, one bill, one thing until it's a totally new America. You can see that, can't you? You can see that happening, can't you? Our call is to suffer. Our call is to suffer, not to fight, not to fight for power. Pray, vote, use your freedom that you have. Do not lose. Do not lose your mind. Your God's big enough. There's hope. There's so much hope. Let this story give you hope. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for your love, for your greatness. You are great. You are huge. You are powerful. You control every nation, every province. You control ours. May we just walk with you. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you. Have a great day.